It's just that I don't want to marry anybody else if I can't marry him. Will you think about it, though? Kathy promised that she would, knowing her answer would always be the same. Is there any more lemonade? Moira Curran asked of no one in particular when she went into the house in Agate Street, closely followed by her friend Nellie Tyler. Dunno, ma'am, replied Jackie, her middle daughter. Do you want us to go and buy some? Biddy asked. No, tile, love. If ours has gone, someone else is bound to have some. It's all gone, Moira, Nellie shouted from the kitchen. Would you and Nellie like a glass of sherry, ma'am? Asked Amy. I wouldn't say no, love. How about you, Nellie? Nellie grinned a trifle drunkenly. I wouldn't say no either. The street was having a party to celebrate the end of the war, and today, the 8th of May, was a bank holiday. With no work to go to, the sisters had gathered around the table in their mother's house for a chat. It was a long time since the three of them had been together for any length of time. Jackie spent most of her weekends with Peter's family in Pond Wood, and Biddy's fiancé, Derek O'Rourke, a trainee fireman, lived over the water in Birkenhead. They were getting married at the end of June. We'd like a baby as soon as possible, Jackie said, after her mother and Nellie Tyler had left the house rather more tipsy than when they'd come in. We're going to try for one as soon as Peter is demobbed. Since Peter had joined the Navy, they'd managed to see each other every few months. I would too, no matter how hard she tried. Amy couldn't imagine Barney being home. She could say it. The words tripped off her tongue quite easily. But Barney being there was another thing altogether. There was an air of quiet satisfaction between them. Mulholland's was no longer making vehicles for the army, and Amy had been allowed to leave. She wanted to be home full time when Barney eventually returned. As Jackie pointed out, the war had ended. The air raids were over. No more ships would be sunk or planes shot down. No more servicemen and women would be killed. That's not true, Amy reminded her. Only the war in Europe is over. The war in Japan has yet to be won. I forgot, Jackie said gloomily. Snatches of song kept drifting into the house through the open front door. When the lights go on again all over the world, they were singing now. It was a glorious day. Sunny and warm. As glorious, Amy pointed out, as the day war had been declared, nearly 6 long years ago. Would you two like a cup of tea? Biddy inquired. I'd love one, Amy said. But has Mam got enough tea? And what about milk? There's plenty of both. I brought some tea with me and our Jackie brought the milk. It's fresh milk, straight from the cow. I got it at the farm this morning. Amy winced. I never remember to bring anything. We've noticed that, haven't we, Jackie? Biddy said sternly. Jackie smiled. It doesn't matter, sis. Your Christmas prezzies more than make up for the milk and tea and stuff like that. That brooch you gave us last year has been admired by all and sundry, and people still stare at the bag you brought from London all those years ago. Biddy nodded. So, you can have a cuppa without feeling guilty. Amy stood. OK, but I'll make it, seeing as how I haven't brought anything towards it. She was in the kitchen, quietly singing Yours Till the Stars Lose Their Glory, along with the rowdy crowd outside, when her sisters came in. There's someone to see you, Jackie said. We've put him in the parlour where it's private, Biddy told her. Amy still hadn't properly understood when she opened the parlour door. She thought they might have meant Leo, though both her sisters knew him well and were unlikely to put him in the parlour, so she wasn't really prepared for the person who was there. Barney! It came out half a groan and half a gasp. When she thought about this impossible thing happening, Barney coming home, she had envisaged him wearing a uniform of sorts, possibly even the greatcoat that had belonged to the person whose name began with W. But he had on a smart dark grey suit, a cream shirt, and a maroon tie. She stared at this stranger. A pale and hollow-eyed Barney stared back at her. He lifted his arms. It was a limp gesture, and his arms barely reached the level of his waist. But it was enough for Amy, who flung herself at him. Oh, Barney! She clung to him, sobbing into his neck, wetting the maroon tie and the collar of his shirt. His arms slid around her, and he held her so tightly that she could hardly breathe. Then he began to cry too. Amy had no idea how long they stayed in the parlour, hardly speaking, just holding each other. People came in and out of the house, and the party outside got rowdier, the singing noisier. Two men had a fight. A football was kicked against the wall for a good 10 minutes. Feet clattered loudly on the pavement as revellers danced an Irish jig. And still they sat, Amy and Barney, hardly able to believe the war was over, that they were back together at long last. They would have to get to know each other all over again. And Amy had a feeling that would be far more difficult than the first time. It was almost June, and on the 1st it would be Amy's birthday. She would be 24, and Barney suggested they went somewhere special to celebrate. "I can't think of anywhere special," Amy said, "unless we have a late honeymoon in London." He'd promised to take her again when their first and last visit had had to be cut short. "We'll go to London one day," Barney declared, "but not just yet. Dad's still showing me how the business works." He'd gone to work for his father, having forgotten or changed his mind about doing something exciting after the war. "This week I'm in the glass-blowing department. It's fascinating to watch." "Are you learning to blow glass?" Amy hoped that wasn't a stupid question. "No, just to see how it's done," he replied impatiently, as if it had been a stupid thing to ask. "Glass-blowing is a trade. It takes ages to learn. Tell you what, let's go to Southport, to the pier where we met that Easter Sunday. It seems a lifetime ago."
"I'd love that."
She was willing to do anything that might make their relationship normal again, stop him being so distant and cold. Only in bed, in the dark and under the covers, was he the old Barney. Even then, it was only while they made love. Before and after, he didn't say a word, just grabbed her and let her go without saying a word. He smoked heavily and never spoke about his time in the prisoner of war camp. It was Amy who started every conversation, at least until Barney had come up with the idea of going somewhere special on her birthday. "It's a pity Harry won't be here," she said. "Kathy's home for a few days, and it would be nice if all four of us could go. We could get the train." It could be months or years before petrol was available and people could use their cars again. Barney murmured in an uninterested way. It so happened that a few days before her birthday, Harry returned to England for the first time since D-Day and was granted 5 days' leave. The weather was horribly cold for June. A chill wind blew across the flat sands of Southport, penetrating the clothes of the few hardy souls who were strolling along the pier. This time it seemed to be Kathy and Harry who wanted to be alone together, while Amy and Barney tagged along behind with hardly a word to say to each other. Kathy and Harry hadn't met since the party in the finance office in Keighley, the first Christmas of the war. So much had happened since. The most important being that Kathy had met Jack, who had died at Harry's side in Egypt. They were desperate to share their memories of the man who had been the lover of one and the dearest friend of the other. Amy wished that she and Barney had come on their own. The presence of the other couple only seemed to emphasize how badly they were getting on. She was quite pleased when he grabbed her arm and said, "Let's walk to the end of the pier, come on." It was a desolate sight, the Irish Sea in the far distance, glistening dully like pewter, while the sand stretched before them, wet and unwelcoming. There wasn't a soul in sight. Barney breathed in and let the breath out again with a satisfied sigh. Very slowly, he let his eyes sweep the horizon. "That looks good," he said. "I wish I could live here for the rest of my life." "I wish you hadn't given up the flat, Amy," he added petulantly. He hated the bungalow. The rooms were too small, the windows too dark because of the thick hedge surrounding the property. Whereas from the windows of their flat, there had been no limit to the view, just the roofs of the nearby houses and endless blue sky. The new house made him feel as if he were still in prison. "Let's look for somewhere else," Amy suggested. She wasn't all that keen on the bungalow either. She would have been only too willing to move elsewhere, but Barney was being awkward. "It doesn't matter," he said sulkily. "This place will grow on me, I suppose." Standing at the end of Southport Pier, he suddenly put his arm around her shoulders. "I'm sorry, darling. I used to dream about coming home, but now I have, and I can't get used to it. I can't get used to four walls. I feel I want to live in the open air, on top of a mountain, where I can walk in any direction with nothing to stop me." Amy kissed his chin. She was expecting too much of him. He'd been confined for 5 long years, and it would be a long time before he became adjusted to freedom. Until then, she would just have to be patient. "Are you two looking to catch pneumonia?" Kathy and Harry had followed them to the end of the pier. Both wore civvies. There was nothing to show that either of them had spent the last 6 years in uniform. Kathy had a headscarf on her neat brown hair, hands stuffed in the pockets of her warm tweed coat, the collar turned up. "I wish I'd put me mink coat on," she laughed. "Could we please go somewhere for a nice hot drink?" By now there were more people about. Half a dozen boys were racing each other from bench to bench. 2 men were fishing. An elderly couple wearing matching knitted cardigans were throwing bread to the seagulls. Barney took charge. "Let's have some tea in the place we went to last time, then go for a wander along Lord Street and have a meal. Does anyone know what films are showing this week?" "Double Indemnity with Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray, and The Lost Weekend with Ray Milland," Kathy said promptly, adding, "I looked in the Echo last night." Barney looked from face to face. "Which one shall we see?" "Let's take a vote on it," Harry suggested. "What happens if each film gets 2 votes?" Barney asked. "Then we'll ask Amy to toss for it, and she'll want to see whichever picture loses," Kathy said. "It's a habit of hers," she explained when the men gave her a puzzled look. "At least it used to be." Amy remembered the last time she'd done it was in Southport, in a cafe in Lord Street, where she and Kathy had had a pot of tea. She couldn't remember the names of the pictures, but Charles Boyer had been in one and Humphrey Bogart in the other. They tossed, and Charles Boyer had won. But she'd wanted to see Humphrey Bogart, so Kathy had given in. She'd never dreamt that, when she went to see the film some hours later, it would be with Barney. That was the day that her life had changed forever. Today it was still changing. Perhaps they should come back, the 4 of them, in another 6 years. She wondered what would have happened by then. Chapter 17. June 1971. Pearl. I'd forgotten how much I hated zoos. If Rob suggested we come again, I'd tell him to take Gary on his own. There was something hideously cruel about wild animals being kept in cages. One of the few things I could remember about my father was that he felt the same. I suppose it was something to do with being in the prisoner of war camp for so long. It was a relief when Gary had seen everything. Rob asked if he'd like to go round a second time, but he declined. "I'm hungry," he announced. "I'm hungry for sausage and chips." We drove into Chester. We'd come in Rob's car and looked for a suitable restaurant, where I ordered cod and chips. It was quite a treat because Marion considered fried food unhealthy. She never made chips, and batter was a dirty word in the house. Today I felt as if I was split in 2. One half of me wanted to be with Rob. The other half longed to be with my mother. My feelings had completely changed since yesterday. I'd never thought we'd get on so well together. Already I was feeling protective towards her, and it really hurt to think she'd spent all those years in prison. Today was her birthday. She was 50, but had insisted she didn't want to fuss. "We can have a party when I'm 51. By then I might be in the mood." One of these days, when there were just the 2 of us, I wanted to talk to her about my father. I'd been remembering the furious rows they'd used to have, the fury always on his side. Her voice was consistently quiet, patient, and reasonable, as she tried to calm him. But that only made him worse. "Haw!" he would scream. Once he'd said, "I really would like to kill you." It had terrified me. I'd wanted to stop him, but didn't know how. Anyway, my mother had killed him first. "Penny for them," Rob said. I stared at him vacantly. "Pardon?" I said, "Penny for them. I've asked twice if you'd like a pudding." "I wouldn't, thank you, but I'd love some tea. I'm sorry," I added apologetically. "I was miles away. I thought of a simple way to be with Rob and my mother at the same time. Would you like to come home with me so Gary can meet Amy? At least I could call her Amy when she wasn't there, though I doubted if I'd ever do it to her face. If you think that's all right, I added hurriedly. Not everyone would be keen on the idea of his or her child having contact with a murderer, however pretty and charming she might be. That'd be great, Rob said. Where are we going? Gary asked. To see Pearl's mother. The little boy looked at me in surprise. Have you got a mummy, miss? Yes, Gary, I have. I didn't discourage him from calling me miss. I didn't want him referring to me as Pearl in class.
Do all teachers have mothers?
They do indeed, I told him. He considered this for a while, frowning, then shrugging as if he found it very mysterious.
And dads too.
And dads too, I confirmed. Within the space of a few minutes, Amy had totally bewitched him. She and Charles were in the garden. Marion had her usual Saturday appointment at the hairdresser's.
My, aren't you handsome? She said admiringly.
She patted the empty chair next to her. My name is Amy. Would you like to sit down and tell me all about yourself? Gary was only too happy to oblige. He described the picture he'd painted that had come second in the competition.
It's an orange lemon tree and rabbits live in the roots. I drew their house. What's it called, Dad? A rabbit's house.
A warren, son.
I drew a warren with curtains on the window. The man from the paper said it showed I had a good... What was it? The man said, Dad.
That you had a good imagination.
The man said I had a good imagination and I'm getting a prize. It's a painting set in a wooden box and the paints are in tubs, not squares.
Tubes, darling, not tubs.
I'll really enjoy squeezing the tubes, Gary said seriously. You can't squeeze squares. Would you like me to paint you a picture when I get the tubes?
Yes, please, I'd love that. And will you do one for my brother? His name is Charlie, and this is him here. Charles smiled benignly.
Yes, I will, Amy, but I'll do a different sort of tree.
You, Amy said, are a truly delightful young man. Would you like to come indoors and I'll make you an ice cream cornet?
Yes, please.
He trotted beside her into the house. And I wondered why my mother hadn't had more children when she so obviously adored them. Half an hour later, Marion returned, her hair short, smooth and black. I was worried she'd be put out to find we had more visitors and was ready to be annoyed if she were. It wasn't often I brought people home, but she was as nice as it was possible for Marion to be. I remembered Rob's old banger of a car was outside, and it was only the other day that she complained to Charles about it. But she showed no sign of having noticed. If she had, she was pretending not to care. She made quite a fuss of Gary, but he was too enamoured of my mother for it to make much of an impression. I don't know if Amy had picked him up or he'd managed to wriggle onto her knee unasked, but they were sitting companionably together on one of the garden chairs while he ate his ice cream cornet. I suppose it was inevitable that Kathy Burns would turn up, irritating Marion and astonishing Gary, whose ideas about teachers were being turned upside down. Rob and Gary stayed for tea. I went inside and helped Marion prepare it. She told me my mother was moving into Kathy Burns's house tomorrow, Sunday. I wished Marion were different, so she could stay. I would really miss her when she'd gone, which was ridiculous when you thought about it. I'd spent most of my life without her, and it hadn't bothered me. Yet she'd only been home a couple of days, and I didn't want her to go. After tea, Rob and Gary went home. Kathy Burns and my mother returned to the garden with a bottle of wine, and Marion and Charles went into the front room to watch television. I reckoned Charles would far sooner have stayed outside. I did. I could watch television any day. That night, their wartime reminiscences developed into a sing-song. The neighbours and their guests in the conservatory next door came out and joined in with When They Begin the Begin, Good Night, Sweetheart, and songs I'd never heard of. Conversations were conducted over the hedge regarding what to sing next. Perhaps it was because Marion had brought me up that I felt so embarrassed. I imagined the singing passing from garden to garden until the whole block was involved. Marion poked her head out of the back door and shouted that there was a phone call for me.
What's going on out there? She asked.
When I went inside, I told her to go back to her television programme, adding, It's best you don't know. It must have been a really interesting programme, because she did. To my surprise, the caller was Hilda Dooley. Even more surprisingly, she was crying. "I need to talk to you," she wept. "Where are you, Hilda?" "In town. I'm in a phone box at Lime Street Station." "Can you come here?" I couldn't go to her, as I'd had too much wine. "You know where I live, don't you?" "Yes, I came once to collect some jumble. You couldn't fit it into the boot of your car." "That's right." The irritating thing about a Volkswagen was that the engine was at the back and the boot at the front, so it hardly held anything. "I'll see you in about 20 or 30 minutes." I wondered what was wrong, then thought it could only be something to do with Clifford. I put the kettle on in readiness for when Hilda arrived and returned to the garden, where everyone was singing "Roll Out the Barrel," a horrible song in my view. I made my point by not joining in. When Hilda arrived, I made tea and took her into what Marion referred to as the breakfast room, more an alcove with a table and built-in wooden benches. It was situated between the kitchen and the hallway. "What's wrong?" I asked, once we were sitting down. Hilda's eyes were bloodshot, and her powdered face was streaked with tears.
"It's Clifford," she said.
"What's he done?"
"Asked me to marry him," Hilda said dolefully.
I was confused. "Is that a bad thing?" Hilda sniffed and wiped her nose with the back of her hand. I hurried into the kitchen and fetched half a dozen paper hankies.
"It is when it turned out that the flat he lives in doesn't belong to him and he wants to move in with me."
She sniffed again, but this time it was more indignant than pathetic.
"I can't help but think he only wants to marry me so he'll have somewhere to live where he doesn't have to pay rent."
"I thought he owned the flat in Norris Green," I said.
"So did I, but apparently he only rents it. He doesn't like it there. Remember, he said that when he showed us the one for sale. And he definitely gave the impression that he owned it."
"Oh, Pearl!"
She began to cry again, big droopy tears that followed the shiny tracks of the tears she'd shed before.
"I thought it was too good to be true, that he was attracted to me when he was so good-looking."
"Don't be daft," I said, though I'd been a bit surprised myself. "Did you agree to marry him?"
"Yes," she groaned. "I feel a real idiot. He asked over dinner, and after I'd said yes, we started to talk about the future. I suggested we use some of the money from the sale of his flat for a new kitchen in mine. It was only then he admitted he didn't have a flat to sell."
Amy came into the kitchen singing "Yours Till the Stars Lose Their Glory," and Hilda looked as if she were about to cry again.
"I'm sorry. Are you having a party? I've disturbed you, haven't I? I'm sorry."
She stumbled to her feet to leave.
"There you are, Pearl," said my mother. "I wondered where you'd gone."
She gave us both a dazzling smile.
"How do you do?" she said to Hilda. "I'm Amy."
She looked really gorgeous today, in a bright red dress with a straight skirt and short sleeves and a white frill around the neck. She wore white sandals with straps no broader than shoelaces.
"This is Hilda," I said. "She teaches at St. Kentigern's."
I wondered if Hilda would recognise the woman she used to see at Mass all those years ago, despite the long blonde hair being short and brown. I didn't care if she did or not. Never again would I tell anyone that my mother was dead. From now on, I'd tell people the truth, and nothing but the truth. Amy sat on my side of the table and shoved me along with her hip. She took hold of Hilda's big red hands in her small white ones. My mother had spent the last 20 years in prison, yet Hilda's hands looked as if she'd been in a chain gang breaking rocks.
"What's wrong, dear?" Amy asked. "You're obviously upset about something."
Hilda didn't look up to going through the whole thing again, so it was left to me to explain why she was so upset.
"She feels she's been taken for a ride," I finished. "Perhaps you have, perhaps you haven't," Amy said enigmatically. "If I were you, I'd tell Clifford I'd changed my mind, that I didn't want to marry him, at least not for a while. If he genuinely loves you, he'll hang on. If he doesn't, he'll take off."
"The thing is, Amy," Hilda whispered, "I don't want him to take off. He's the first man who's wanted to marry me, and I'd sooner keep him."
"Which would you prefer, Hilda, to
be Mrs. Clifford, whatever his name is, unsure if your husband really loves you, or a single, independent woman with a good job and your own flat. For a few seconds, Hilda seemed confused. Then she nodded a few times and said, slightly shamefacedly, "You'll be shocked, but I'd sooner be married any day than single, whether Clifford loves me or not. And I've always wanted children. I'm only 37. There's still time." Amy didn't appear the least bit shocked. "In that case, next time you see Clifford, tell him you want children. You can't raise a family in a one-bedroom flat. You'd have to buy a house, and he'd have to take out a mortgage. See what he thinks about that." She squeezed Hilda's hands. "I came in for another bottle of wine," she said. "Cathy will think I've gone all the way to Spain to fetch it." "She's nice," Hilda remarked when my mother had gone. "Is she a relative?" "She's my mother," I said. "Her name's Amy Patterson, and she's not long out of prison." It was Sunday, and Charles had taken my mother's belongings to Cathy's house. They consisted of a large, expensive suitcase full of lovely clothes, most of which had been bought in Paris. My mother had gone to lunch with Uncle Harry. I felt quite pleased about it. "Is there a chance they'll get together?" I asked Charles. "After all, he's her brother-in-law. She met him at the same time as she met my father." "No chance at all," Charles said dismissively. "If Harry was going to get together with anyone, it'd be Cathy." "Cathy?" I gasped. "They had something going during the war, or at least they nearly did. I'm not exactly sure what happened, but it was before she met Jack." "Who's Jack?" "Cathy's fiancé. He died at El Alamein." "Why haven't you told me all this before?" I said crossly. "It's so fascinating. What was Jack like?" Charles shrugged. "I don't know. I never met him. But ask your Uncle Harry next time you see him. Jack was his best friend." "Damn," I muttered. "I hated not knowing things." That afternoon, Marion said, "Pearl, your mother's left her cardigan behind, the blue one. Did you say you were going to Southport this afternoon with Rob?" "Yes, I'm picking him and Gary up at 2:30. Do you want me to drop the cardigan off at Cathy's on the way?" She probably wanted rid of it, so my mother wouldn't have an excuse to come back. "If you don't mind." Actually, Cathy lived in Crosby, and it wasn't on my way, but Gary would love to see Amy if she were back by then. Cathy Burns lived in a small tree-lined cul-de-sac of small detached houses that had been built about 20 years before. As expected, Charles's car, a dark green Cortina, was parked outside the one covered with red ivy, which looked lovely in the summer, but not so nice in winter, when the leaves disappeared, leaving the branches crawling all over the walls. "I don't think my mother's here," I said to Rob. "Otherwise Uncle Harry's car would be outside too. He wouldn't just drop her off and go away again." I got out of the car and promised I wouldn't be a minute. The first thing I noticed when I walked down the path was that the curtains downstairs were closed, which I thought was rather strange on such a lovely sunny day. A really perverse, truly horrible suspicion entered my mind, and when I arrived at the front door, I felt reluctant to knock. I stood there, hugging the cardigan and wondering what to do. I went around the back. That's where they would be, in the garden. Why hadn't I thought about that before? But if they were, they were being awfully quiet. Charles and Cathy weren't in the garden, and when I looked through the kitchen and dining room windows, they weren't there either. "Perhaps they've gone for a walk," Rob said later when I told him. "Or a drink," he laughed. "You've got a dirty mind, Pearl." "I must have, mustn't I? What did you do with the cardie?" "I left it on the back step. But when I did, I'm pretty sure I heard a woman's laugh inside the house." On Monday, I'd hardly been home 5 minutes when the telephone rang. I guess somehow it would be my mother. "What are you doing tonight?" she inquired. She was calling from a phone box. "Nothing in particular. I just had to prepare tomorrow's lessons." "How do you fancy going to the cavern?" There was an undercurrent of excitement in her voice. "The cavern? Why? Do you want to see what it's like?" She was the sort of person who would have loved the cavern. It was a shame that she'd missed it when Liverpool was the most important city on the earth. "I'm meeting a friend. Her name is Susan Conway, and her son is playing there tonight. He's a guitarist." "I'd love to go." My interest increased. "What's the name of the group?" "The Umbrella Men.
Have you heard of them? All I knew was that they'd played at the cavern before.
Yes, I told her.
She said she was calling from George Henry Lee's and would do a bit more shopping before meeting Susan Conway at 6 for a meal. I promised to be at the cavern by 8 and to drive her home. She muttered something about buying a car and rang off. I hadn't remembered she could drive and wondered where the money would come from to buy a car. We'd been quite well off when I was little. I suppose there'd have been money mounting up in the bank all this time. Even if there weren't, I felt sure Grandad wouldn't let her go short.
Marion sniffed disapprovingly when I came downstairs that night, in my new blue jeans and flared black top. I tied my hair back for a change and told myself I looked like a beatnik. It was a bit late in the day for that, but my friend Trish used to say I dressed too conventionally. I was reminded that I hadn't heard from her in ages and made a mental vow to give her a ring soon. I wondered how London was treating her. Amy and her friend Susan looked old enough to be everybody's mother when I met them later in the cavern. Susan wore outsized crimpoline trousers and a beige nylon jumper on her ample frame, and my mother had chosen a simple peasant dress in flowered cotton. It appeared she had met Susan during the war, and they had remained in contact ever since. In those days, the Umbrella Men's guitarist had been a mere babe in arms. He was now 31. "Me other two kids have been married for years and have kids of their own, but our Stevens had more girlfriends than hot dinners and shows no sign of settling down," his mother snorted, though I could tell from her shining eyes she was extremely proud of her youngest son. When she got married, she told me, she'd gone to live in a little village called Pond Wood, not far from Kirkby, but had moved back to Bootle to live with her mam when her husband had died a few years ago. "Pond Wood's where I met you, mam," she said. "She worked on the station. As soon as I read in the paper about what had happened with your dad, I knew there must have been a good reason for it. Your mam's a lovely person. She wouldn't hurt a fly." My mother looked embarrassed. A voice from the past screamed, "Ho!" I wondered if she would ever explain to me exactly what had gone on the night my father had died. There were three groups on the bill. The Umbrella Men were second. I thought the first one perfectly okay, but Susan and my mother kept looking at each other and rolling their eyes at their apparent awfulness. The Umbrella Men comprised two guitarists, a drummer, and a pianist. The lead guitarist stationed himself behind the microphone and searched the audience with his eyes until they rested on Susan, whereupon he gave a wide smile. Susan dug me sharply in the ribs, saying, "That's him. That's our Stephen." Stephen's gaze transferred to me, and he smiled again. A warm sensation washed over me, as if in some way I had been uniquely blessed. I stared at him hard, hoping for another smile, but he was busy tuning his guitar and telling the audience what to expect. "A couple of songs written by Pete here on drums and Alf on piano, some Jerry Lee Lewis numbers followed by a couple more from our very own Jerry on bass and yours truly." There was a cheer from Susan. "Thanks, Ma." The audience laughed and he continued. "There won't be a pause between numbers, so there's no need to clap until we finish." He was completely at home on stage, at ease with the mic. His accent was more Lancashire than Liverpool. Stepping back, he started to play, and I studied him. He wasn't very tall, about 5'10", I reckoned, and wore a scruffy black leather jacket, black jeans and T-shirt. A gold earring glittered in his left ear, and golden brown hair tumbled onto his shoulders in untidy waves and curls. He was boyishly handsome, and looked more in his early 20s than 31. To be frank, he wasn't the sort of man I was usually attracted to. Was I attracted to him? In the past, I stayed well clear of men like him. I was too shy, and they were too extrovert. I didn't know what to think. I'd been told that when my mother met my father, it had been love at first sight, that it had happened just like that. Whoever it was had clicked their fingers, just like that. It was Uncle Harry. He'd actually been there. I was about 16. It was his birthday, and he'd had a bit too much to drink. I remember how sad he'd been, but drunk or sober, Uncle Harry had never seemed truly happy. Stephen Conway was singing about being lost. He was alone and couldn't find his way out of the darkness, was searching for a light. His voice was soft and mournful. All of a sudden the audience were applauding and there were shouts of appreciation. I'd hardly heard a thing. Susan was clapping so hard it must be hurting her hands. The umbrella men left the stage and there was an interval. We left and made our way along Matthew Street to Labitte's, the coffee bar where Stephen would shortly join us. I'd completely forgotten about Rob while we were in the cabin, yet normally he was rarely far from my thoughts. My mother asked if the umbrella men were able to live off their music or if they had daytime jobs. "They're in and out of work like yo-yos," Susan replied. She sounded quite pleased about it, as if she liked the idea of having an unconventional son. "They drop everything if they get a gig in another part of the country, or an audition, which are nearly always in London. Some firms will stand for it, but others won't. If just one or two of them are working, they support the others till they get a job." The door opened, and Stephen Conway came in, with his guitar on his back. He gave a smile that took in every single person there, then sat in a chair slightly behind me, bent his head until I could feel his breath on my ear, and said, "Hi." "Hello," I stammered. "I mean, hi." "And who are you?" he asked. His mother heard. She said, "This is Pearl, Amy's girl. She's a school teacher." "I bet you could teach me a few things," Stephen said. I swallowed nervously. "I doubt it." I couldn't think of a single thing he could be taught. "Well, not by me." There was a girl on the next table with creamy blonde hair, the skirt of her A-line dress halfway up her thighs. She was much more his type. I'd like to bet she could teach him a thing or two. As in the cavern, time seemed to pass without my noticing. All I was aware of was Stephen's face close to mine. He asked me questions about my work and my favourite music, and told me about the places he'd been with the umbrella men, places like Australia and Canada and Germany, how they'd nearly got a record contract once, but the guy who'd auditioned them had got the sack the following day. My mother and Susan were chatting away, but every now and then I caught my mother looking at me worriedly. At least, I think I did. The warm sensation I'd had earlier was still there. I was breathing a little faster than usual and was conscious of the beating of my heart. I think I could have sat there forever, never moving, listening to Stephen. Except it wasn't possible. Life had to move on. The others got to their feet and I followed. Outside, my mother and Susan walked in front. Stephen asked me out. I accepted. He was playing in the cavern at lunchtime on Saturday, and again in the evening. We would go somewhere in between. I didn't ask where. He didn't come with me to my car, but went off with his mother, while I insisted on taking mine home. "Did Stephen ask you out?" she asked, as I was driving out of the car park. "Yes." I half expected her to give me a lecture, or advise me to be careful. But she said no more. We were going through Bootle when I asked if she would always live with Auntie Cathy. "Good gracious me, no. I love Cathy to bits, but she drives me mad, never stops talking." She looked out of the window at the sun that was setting in the summer blue sky. "No, Pearl, I've no idea where I'm going to live or what I'm going to do once I get used to being out of prison." "Does that mean you might leave Liverpool?" I found the idea upsetting. "I honestly don't know, Pearl." "Look," she said, turning towards me. "While there's just the two of us, would you like to ask questions about your father?" "Not just now. I'd sooner do it when I wasn't driving and we were somewhere quiet. And I wasn't prepared. Try as I might, I was unable to think of a single question apart from, why did my father call you a whore?" Charles had said there was no reason for it, but I would still have liked to ask. Chapter 18, 1945 to 1951. Amy. Barney was almost his old self again by the time Pearl was born. He had adjusted to life in the bungalow and spent a lot of time digging the long garden. He never planted anything, just spent hours turning over the soil. When he finished, he'd turn over the same soil again. Pearl was such a good baby right from the start. Amy would lie her in her cot, then sit on the white padded chair in the nursery and watch her beautiful little girl gradually fall asleep, her eyes blinking until they stayed closed, her long dark lashes resting, quivering ever so slightly on her creamy cheeks. When Barney came home from work, he would sit on the white chair while Amy made their tea. "It's ready, love," she would come in and whisper, pleased to be snatching another glimpse of Pearl before they went to eat. Amy could tell that Barney was secretly delighted his daughter was so like him. He'd expect their child to be blonde and blue-eyed, like his wife. But Pearl's blue eyes had eventually turned the same rich brown as his, and she had the same smooth brown hair. A photo of him as a baby showed he'd once had a little pointed chin and snub nose, too. It was Barney who had accidentally chosen the name. Amy had leapt upon it, anything to please him and subdue the bitterness and bad temper with which he had viewed the world when he first came back from Germany, and which she prayed would never return. Pearl hadn't been included on the mental list of male and female names she'd had in mind, but Barney had appeared in the maternity ward of the private hospital in Prince's Park and remarked that the new baby, with her creamy, lustrous skin, reminded him of a pearl. "That's what we'll call her. Pearl," Amy said quickly. She quite liked the name. It was unusual, but not so unusual that people would remark on it. A woman in the hospital who'd had a daughter at the same time had called her Scarlet, after Scarlet O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. "Poor child," people had observed. "Everyone will know where it came from." Pearl was perfect. For 18 months after Pearl was born, life was as normal as it would ever be. Amy and her mother-in-law called a truce. It was a very reluctant truce on Amy's side, and may well have been on Mrs. Patterson's. They never discussed the matter. Amy always made an effort to prevent them being alone together, not trusting either of them to hold their tongues. Leo, well aware of the situation, did his best to make sure the atmosphere stayed calm. It wasn't really surprising that Elizabeth Patterson refused to come to Pearl's christening. To see her one and only grandchild baptized a Catholic was asking too much of a woman who was Protestant through and through. It was, however, a pleasure to Moira Curran, Pearl's other grandmother, a proof that life was returning to normality after the war. Moira had emerged from the conflict 6 years older and with three of her four children married with homes of their own. Biddy was also married, but she and her husband were living with Moira until they found a place. Soon Moira would live alone in the house in Agate Street, a situation for which she was fully prepared. During the war, she had received three proposals of marriage from three different men. She had turned them all down. She had only loved one man in her life, and he had died when her children were small. Now she had a really nice job in the gas showroom on Stanley Road, and the rest of her life would be spent with the spirit of the man she had loved, and the grandchildren that would eventually appear. Barney was working for his father's company in Skelmersdale, but was worried Harry was being sidelined. "Dad has no faith in him. He treats him like an idiot," he said to Amy one night. Much to her surprise, Amy seemed to be the only person that Leo Patterson would listen to. "If Barney's noticed," she remonstrated, "so will other people. That won't do Harry's confidence much good." "I want Harry and Barney to be directors of the company," he growled. "But Harry doesn't show much initiative. He's very slow at catching on." "Harry," Amy said in an angry voice, "was in the war from when it started until well after the end when he was demobbed. He was at Dunkirk and took part in the D-Day landings. He fought in the desert and all the way across Europe until the Germans surrendered. You should be proud of him, not complain. He's a sticker. He does what he sets out to do. If he's slow at catching on, it really doesn't matter, because he'll do it in the end." Leo laughed. "You, Mrs. Patterson, are a typical example of an old head on young shoulders. I'll remember what you said and treat Harry with more respect from now on." She glared at him, unsure whether he was joking or not. "I jolly well hope so," she said threateningly, and he laughed again. Everything was going swimmingly until the night the man came to see Barney. Until then, their lives had assumed a sort of pattern. Dinner with Barney's family and tea with Amy's on alternate weekends. Petrol was still rationed, but drivers were allowed a basic amount. Cars were retrieved from the garages and gardens where they had been laid up for the duration of the war and made fit to drive again. Every few weeks, Barney drove to Pond Wood, where Jackie and Peter lived in a small cottage with their own newborn son, taking Amy's mother with them. Occasionally they went to see Charlie and Marion in Aintree, though Marion never made them feel welcome. It was September when the man came, a strange day early in autumn, when a poisonous yellow fog gripped Liverpool and the air smelled as if fires were burning somewhere close but out of sight. It was tea time when Amy answered the door to the visitor. He was beautifully dressed, in a camel overcoat and nut-brown trilby hat. He looked about 30 years of age and was quite handsome, albeit in an effeminate way. "Is this the home of Barney Patterson?" he inquired politely, removing his hat. He had a foreign accent, only faintly discernible. Amy acknowledged that it was. She put him in the parlour, apologising for the fact it wasn't very warm, but saying that she was feeding their toddler in the living room. Pearl was inclined to make a great game out of being fed with a spoon, and the visitor was likely to be splashed with mashed carrots or apple puree. When she got back, Barney had already started on the feed, a tea towel tucked underneath his chin. He was pretending the spoon was an aeroplane, or it might have been a wasp, making it fly through the air with a buzzing sound until the contents came in contact with Pearl's mouth, when she might eat it, or she might not. "There's someone to see you," Amy said. "He's in the parlour." "What's his name?" "I didn't ask, I'm sorry. Here, shall I do that, and you can see to him?" She took the spoon, removed the tea towel, and set about giving Pearl the rest of her tea. Little knowing that something was happening in the parlour that would change her life forever. The man was sitting on the edge of the linen-covered settee, his hat beside him, leaning against the tapestry cushions that had been a present from Barney's mother the Christmas before last. He jumped to his feet when Barney entered and came towards him, hand extended, a broad smile on his face.
"Hello, old chap. We can greet each other in a more civilised way now that the damn war is over."
It was Franz Jaeger, the translator from the castle in Bavaria. Barney blinked, convinced that he must be seeing things or that this was just a dream. But the man was real. He closed the parlour door in case Amy could hear.
"What are you doing here?" he croaked, ignoring the man's outstretched hand.
"I thought I would look you up. This is a social call."
He seemed rather put out that his hand hadn't been taken.
"I think I told you I was employed by Mercedes-Benz in Mayfair before the war."
He looked at Barney as if waiting for affirmation of this fact, but none came.
"When the war ended, I returned to London, not to the same job, but only too happy to be back."
"I asked what you were doing here."
Barney's voice was thick with rage.
"I've already said I thought I would look you up. I'm on my way to Ireland with some friends and passing through Liverpool. I remembered you lived here and found your address in the telephone directory."
He frowned, clearly hurt.
"I had thought we were friends. I kept you well provided with cigarettes during the unfortunate time we were thrown together. I hated the war as much as you."
Barney collapsed on one of the blue linen armchairs. He could have done with a cigarette right then, but had cut down drastically, and there were none in the house.
"After what happened, you are the last person I want to see."
"What happened? You mean that business with the commandant? But why should that upset you? He told me later that you appeared not to mind a bit, that you actually enjoyed it."
Barney felt as if every drop of blood had drained from his body. "How ridiculous!"
It was a limp word to use, but on the spur of the moment he'd been unable to think of anything stronger. Outrageous would have been better.
"Look," the visitor said reasonably, "I have a taxi waiting outside. My friends are in the bar of the Adelphi Hotel. Why don't you come and we can all have a drink together?" "Are your friends homosexual?"
Franz Jaeger's eyes narrowed, and he looked thoughtful.
"Yes, they are. As a matter of fact, like me. And like you, only you refuse to acknowledge it. That's why you're so upset to see me, isn't it?"
"I have a wife and a child,"
Barney said harshly. In no way am I like you and your friends. It is possible to love both men and women. Colonel Hoffacker had a wife.
Man got to his feet. He looked very regretful.
I am so sorry. I wouldn't have dreamed of coming, had I known the way you felt. I sincerely apologize, and hope you will be happy with your wife and child.
He picked up his hat.
Auf Wiedersehen, Lieutenant. I will leave my card just in case you wish to contact me one day.
He waved Barney down when he made a move to stand.
Don't worry. I'll see myself out.
He left the room, and a few seconds later the front door closed.
Barney reached for the little white card on the mantelpiece and tore it to pieces, then threw the pieces onto the fire that had been neatly set by the cleaning woman, Mrs. Mackay, so all it needed was a match when visitors were expected. Then he went back to Amy and Pearl. The silences were preferable, the moody silences that could go on for days, even weeks. Amy talked far too much to fill in the long, hushed periods, during which she was overconscious of the ticking of the clock, her breathing, and the little squeaking sounds from outside when it was growing dark and the birds were settling down to sleep. The rages could also go on for weeks. Amy could do or say nothing right. The food was too hot or too cold, too well done or not done enough. If she tried to calm him, she used the wrong words. She was relieved some nights when he drove into town and had dinner on his own. She always tried to be in bed by the time he came home, and pretended to be asleep when he joined her. They hardly ever made love, and when they did, there was an awkwardness about it, as if they were strangers. Then there were the times when he was so sorry for having lost his temper, for saying this or saying that. He didn't know what had got into him. He was sorry, so very, very sorry, and would never behave that way again. Would she forgive him? Amy always did. But it didn't stop Barney from going through the same routine again. The silences, the rages, the pleas for forgiveness. He had started to smoke heavily too, at least 60 a day. He flatly refused to see a doctor. Leo consulted his friend Dr. Sheard, who in turn consulted a psychiatrist, who said he couldn't pass an opinion without speaking to Barney. At a guess, he could only assume the years spent in captivity had done something to his mind, twisted it in some way.
He suggested Barney is more mentally fragile than we'd thought, Dr. Sheard reported.
I'd never have believed it.
Leo shook his head in astonishment. Amy had never given a thought to Barney's mental state, or anybody else's come to that. To her, he'd always seemed very strong in every way, though she remembered the times during the war when he'd crept out of the house at the dead of night rather than wish her goodbye. Did that mean he was mentally fragile? He snapped out of one of his long silent periods by accusing her of sleeping with other men. It was the first time he'd suggested such a thing.
Barney, she cried, what a terrible thing to say.
It's true, though, isn't it?
His eyes burnt into hers.
You're a whore.
How dare you say that?
It was what his mother had called her when they'd first met.
I've never been unfaithful to you, and never will.
He contemplated her answer for at least half a minute. She knew he was trying to think of a reason for his accusation.
I can't believe you didn't sleep with other men when I was away all that time, he said sulkily.
You can believe whatever you like, Barney, but I know I didn't.
She usually put up with his bad temper, but now she was really angry.
If you say anything like that again, I'll take Pearl and go and live with Mam.
He was instantly apologetic.
But I can't live without you, he groaned. I'll die if you're not here. I need you, darling. I need you more than I've ever done before.
Of course I won't leave, she assured him. She took him in her arms and could feel him trembling. He was ill, very ill, and she'd vowed to stay with him in sickness and in health. She could never bring herself to desert her beloved Barney. Kathy Burns finished her course at Kirkby Teacher Training College and emerged a fully qualified teacher. She bought a car and rented a small flat in Upper Parliament Street. Her first job was at a school in Toxteth, and she frequently called on Amy after she'd finished work. Amy had never appreciated her friend more. Most days she managed to get out of the house for a few hours, but there were days when Pearl had a cold or she didn't feel well herself or it was raining.
It was such a joy to see Kathy after hours spent in the house with just a toddler for company. Mind you, Pearl was becoming more interesting, the older she grew. But Amy couldn't exactly discuss with her whatever accusation her father had thrown at her the night before, or tell her that she suspected he was seeing another woman.
"Jesus!"
Kathy gasped when Amy confided in her. "What makes you think that?" She looked very smart in a black costume with a cream jumper underneath, her hair stylishly short. Amy told her every little thing that Barney had said or done. It helped to have someone to talk to, who would understand. Leo was the only other person she confided in, and there were certain things you couldn't tell a man. He telephoned nearly every day to see how she was, and impressed upon her he would come at the drop of a hat if needed, though she didn't see him nearly as much as she'd done during the war. 3 times this week he didn't come home from work until 8:30 or 9 o'clock, Amy told her friend, but Leo says he always leaves at about 5:30. When he did arrive, he smelt of cheap scent. Where does he say he's been? In a pub drinking?